Hey guys, welcome to the next episode of the Dog Real Talk program. Our guest today is one of the biggest names in the animal training, Ken Ramirez. And our topic is conservation training. Stay with us, listen, and share your thoughts in the comments. Thank you so much for joining me in today's episode. I'm very grateful that you agreed to be a guest in my program. I would love to talk to you about conservation training.
Oh, excellent.
And maybe if we could start by explaining what is conservation training.
Well, for me, I have always been very passionate about conservation. Conservation can come in many forms, but as someone who studied and went through college as a biologist, particularly with a focus on animal life, I've always been concerned about the impact that we as humans have on our planet, whether it be cutting down of the forests or polluting of the oceans. There's a constant challenge that animals face due to human technology, to human growth, to human effort. And as passionate as I am about it, I am also by profession a trainer, a behaviorist. And I always wondered whether there was a way that I could combine my desire to help conservation projects with my knowledge about animal behavior, and was there a connection between the two? Normally, most people don't see a connection. They assume that if you're going to be working on conservation projects with animals in the wild, that you would never train them and there wouldn't be no behavioral component. But over the years, one of the things that I've discovered is that there are ways that we as trainers can contribute to conservation projects. The more knowledgeable we are about behavior, the more we understand about why animals behave the way they do, there are things that we can potentially do that will impact or affect their behavior. Some examples of common conservation work that is going on many times there are dog programs that exist that do canine conservation work, where dogs are trained to use their nose to potentially look for the defecation of certain species of animals, or to look for the eggs of certain species of animals, or to search for turtles or for snakes, or there's a project in Canada right now where big ships that come into their ports come in with zebra mussels attached to the ships. And zebra mussels are invading a lot of Canada's waterways. So they've trained dogs to be able to sniff out zebra mussels. And if they find them, then they don't let those ships into their waters until they've been decontaminated. It is projects like that allow us to use our knowledge of training of dogs to help with species in the wild. And that was some of the early work that I observed and that I learned about. But then, as time went on, I just happened to realize that there were projects that I could potentially be involved with in which we might shape the work of polar bears in the wild, or chimpanzees in the wild, or elephants in the wild, and using a technique called remote training to accomplish that. And so that's sort of this broad overview. I don't know which direction you'd like to talk about it all in, but that's sort of what I mean by conservation training, training that helps protect a species of animals in the wild.
So we can actually say, I have this thought because I've listened to your lecture in Convergence Conference, Convergence 2018, and it was about convergence of human and animal training. So can we say that conservation training is kind of a convergence between training and protecting animals and wildlife?
Absolutely. A lot of times what happens in national parks, in park reserves, or in wild populations is wildlife biologists are trying to find ways of managing those wild populations to protect them, to help provide a good home for them. And so conservation training is an intersection where general animal wildlife protection policies are combined with animal behavior policies to try to find a solution to challenges that animals might be facing, either because of natural threats or human threats. It's usually human threats that cause the problem.
No, that's wonderful. And how can we, if we want to point out the differences, or are there differences if we work with wild animals that live in natural habitats, and when we work with maybe even the same animals, but in a zoo environment?
Well, I think there's a couple of big differences, but I think to start with, what I would say is, as a trainer, the differences are minor in that the laws of learning apply no matter the species. So if I'm going to use a reinforcer to try to change behavior, it's the same kind of reinforcers and it has the same impact on behavior, whether I'm talking about an elephant or I'm talking about a dog in our home, whether I'm working in the wild or I'm working in a zoological environment, those laws of learning are exactly the same. However, given that the laws of learning are the same, there still are huge differences in working with an animal in the wild. In the wild, there are no barriers. There are no constraints to where the animal can go. When we work with our dogs at home or when we work with an animal in a zoo, there are walls, there are barriers, there are limits to where the animals can go. And that allows us to potentially control the distractions or control the reinforcers and punishers that might be in that environment. When you're working in the wild, you have no control over where the animals go. You have no control that if I'm working with a group of animals, that a different species of animal might come around the corner and distract things, that there might not be any number of natural predators or natural prey items that animal either wants to run away from or wants to chase after. There are just lots of other activities going on that cause you to have very, very limited control. And that is often a challenge for trainers. One of the biggest challenge a lot of pet trainers have is simply trying to control their dog's environment so that they can shape behavior. Well, now imagine taking that and having no control over those environmental factors, but yet you still have to be able to train. And so that is one of the big differences, is that it's a bigger challenge because the world is a big place and there aren't as many ways of controlling that animal's environment to be able to affect behavior.
Wow, yes, it seems like a really big challenge because, as you said, we often struggle with a limited environment and
right.
having work. But also, I think that you often work with a group of animals, right? Not only
right.
the environment, but also here that the animals you're working, it's not only your one dog in front of you.
Exactly. When I work, I give you some examples. I did a project with chimpanzees in Sierra Leone. In that particular project, we were at one time trying to shape the behavior of over 125 animals. I'm working on a project in Africa right now with elephants, mm-hmm. and we're working with somewhere approximately 375 animals all at one time. And so when I was working on a project with bilbies in Australia, we were dealing with over 200 animals all at once. And they're spread out over a big area, but you're still trying to change and shape behavior. So not only is there the challenge of not having barriers, mm-hmm. but there's the challenge of having to shape the behavior of multiple animals all at the same time. And then another challenge is the politics and people part of training, because when it comes to working with your dog at home, maybe it's just the husband and wife and the trainer that might have to argue and agree on what they want their dog to do. But when you start working with wild animals, you have government agencies, you have environmental agencies, you have animal rights groups, you have biologists, you have the local people who live in the area, all of which have an opinion and a stake in what happens. And so unlike pet training when it might be two or three people that you have to agree on what you want to do with your dog or cat's behavior. With wildlife training and conservation training, you are sometimes talking about 30 or 40 different agencies. And each of those agencies may have dozens of people who have differing opinions about what needs to be done. And so oftentimes, being able to work with the people, being able to deal with the politics, being able to challenge all of those things, those are big obstacles that we have to overcome before we ever set foot into the natural world and start trying to change behavior. Often it requires special permits and it requires special observers. It requires participation of park rangers. It requires participation of biologists and animal rights groups, all to be there to oversee the project and to make sure that you're following protocols and that the animals are being treated properly, all for very good reason, but it adds an extra layer of complication.
Absolutely, it does. And you mentioned also, because at the beginning, you mentioned that a few examples with, for example, dogs searching for turtle eggs, helping in this way to protect the environment, but it doesn't always involve another dog, another animal to work as a conservation project. You often shape behaviors of multiple animals, as you said, elephants or chimpanzees, right?
That is correct. An example, I worked on a project in Australia with an animal called a bilby. A bilby is a small rodent-like animal that is a marsupial. There was a major highway construction project that went on in Australia, and they inadvertently ended up putting a barrier across this across the outback that isolated several hundred bilbies onto a side of the highway where they were subject to predation of feral cats coming out of the cities. And their intention had been, their hope had been that when the highway went through the outback, that all of the bilbies would end up on the other side of the highway, but they didn't plan it very well. And so ultimately, and the bilbies are an endangered species. At the time of this project, there were only about 700 bilbies left in all of Australia. And turns out they ended up trapping over almost 300 of them. Half that population ended up being on the wrong side of the highway, and they started being devoured by feral cats. Mm-hmm. So the question was, first they thought about trying to capture the bilbies to relocate them, but they thought that was going to be very stressful, very difficult to do. And so I worked very closely with a number of the zoological parks in Australia, and we designed a program in which we started reinforcing the bilbies for coming to specially designed feeding stations that we created. And then after we got them all, the majority of them trained to come to these feeding stations, we dug these tunnels under the highway. And these tunnels were very similar to the kind of burrows that these animals live in naturally. And then once we had the animals reliably coming to to these feeding stations, these feeding stations were made out to look like bushes. The food was a variety of insects and berries that those animals naturally would eat. And we put it on a cue, but the cue was a sound of a wind coming through the bushes, but a very loud version of that. They would come. And once that worked, we then began approximating these bush feeding stations into the tunnels, through the tunnels, and then to the other side of the highway. And over a period of about 6 weeks, we managed to get almost 250 bilbies to go through the tunnels to the other side of the highway. And once we got to a point where all of the bilbies were coming to the other side of the highway, the tunnels then were closed, mm-hmm. so that the bilbies couldn't get back over to the side of the highway where they were in danger. Mm-hmm. And they ended up building new burrows, building new homes, and there may have been 20 or 30 bilbies that were not found, that were not moved, but the majority of that population moved. And this project took place over 15 years ago. that population of bilbies is still stable and has not declined. And it would have declined significantly, probably by as much as 50%, had we not been able to relocate those bilbies to the other location. But a big part of that project is using what we call remote training, mm-hmm. where the animals don't ever see us, so that they don't become acclimated to people. They don't get habituated to people. They don't start to trust people, because for wild animals, that can be a very dangerous thing. In most of the training that we do in our homes or in a zoo, we want to build a relationship, because that relationship can be a good part of the reinforcement process. But for wildlife training, you don't want there to be a relationship. So we train the animals without the animals ever seeing us. And we have to create these special apparatus to feed them and reinforce them. And we're watching through cameras and through computer screens so that we can affect the behavior, but yet keep them wild and keep it as natural as possible.
Wow. I mean, that sounds so amazing. And it means that you actually mentioned something I wanted to ask you about, the remote training, because what you said about the tunnels and the feeding stations, it means there are no trainers present, right? There, everything happens, as you said, because we don't want to animals to get used to people. We want them to be so it's more like an antecedent arrangement in many aspects.
It is, but we are using remote controlled feeding devices or ways of being able to reinforce behavior. We are watching the behavior through cameras that we have installed so that we can make sure that the behavior is working and that it's happening. But yes, we are setting the environment up to help the animals learn what we want them to learn, but we don't want to affect or change their natural behavior. Mm-hmm. And so we have to set it up in a very special way so that we accomplish those tasks.
Okay, so because you don't want to change natural behavior, does it also involve the knowledge from ethology, so you know more about the species that you are working with?
Absolutely. For every single one of these projects, I as a biologist am very familiar with lots of different species of animals, but I could not consider myself an expert on bilbies or an expert on polar bears or elephants. And so in every project, there's a need to have a number of ethologists and biologists who specialize in that particular species, who understand their migration patterns, their foraging patterns, their eating habits, their social habits, so that we can make sure that the plan that we put together doesn't end up interrupting those very important natural habits. And including them in the process is important. The Bilby Project's a good example, because when I was contacted to ask if I would help with the Bilby Project, while I said it yes immediately, I didn't know what a bilby was. I had never heard of a bilby before. I had to go onto the internet and Google it just so that I could see what it looked like. And so obviously, I might be a knowledgeable about behavior, mm-hmm. but I'm not knowledgeable about this particular species. And so that's where, one, I had to do some of my own independent research, but I also had to rely on the teamwork of working with specialists mm-hmm. who know that species well. And that's probably one of those challenges of working in conservation training, is it requires huge team effort, because it requires having expertise in a lot of areas. Same thing with digging a tunnel underneath a major highway. I have no idea how to do that safely. I have no idea what the right way to accomplish that is. It isn't going to compromise the structure of the highway. So there you have to have government agencies and engineers involved in the project to help you build and design it in a way that's going to be safe for the cars passing over the highway. There's all these different things that you don't think about until you start putting a project together and you realize, I don't know how to do that, or I don't know how to do that well. I need to find an expert who can help me with that. And so yes, that kind of expertise is very valuable and critical if you're going to be successful with a conservation project.
And also money, I think it's an important factor, isn't it? Because it's very expensive to build a tunnel under, for example, build a tunnel under highway.
Yes, exactly. And we ended up building five tunnels in five different places under this highway. So that was expensive. Or having the technology to be able to watch the animals via a remote camera and being able to view that is expensive. Some of these projects require large sums of money to accomplish them. So often it's about finding a government agency that's willing to pay for it, or an environmental group that's willing to pay for it to fund these kind of efforts. And so they can be very expensive, and they don't come with a guarantee. As we all know with behavior, if we can put a plan together properly, we know that we can change behavior. But there are so many outside factors that influence whether or not a project is successful. When you go into these projects, I mean, I've been very fortunate that I've probably been involved in, I don't know, 20 plus different major conservation projects, but they haven't all been successful. The majority of them have, but there's been some projects that after 16 years of work, we did not accomplish what we started to accomplish. We made some progress, but we can't call it a successful project. The conservation project that we had planned, the things that we had planned to do, weren't able to be done. And so at the end of 16 years and lots of money, you have to realize that sometimes it might not always work. And so that's a risk that you take, and that becomes a major factor as well.
And usually, from your experience, the factor that affects the success of the project is the fact that we work in the environment that we cannot control, and that there are many variables you can control. And sometimes, even if you try hard, it's impossible.
Right. Or unexpected things occur. I was working on a project here in the United States. We had a problem with sea lions that were coming to a dam. A dam had been built to garner energy for water energy for use in electricity. And they built a salmon ladder in the dam for fish to go upstream to spawn. And when they built the dam, they didn't expect the fact that California sea lions would find the fish ladder and sit there and eat all the salmon as it went up the ladder. Well, the salmon were an endangered species. Mm-hmm. And so they spent 20 years trying to scare the sea lions away, relocate the sea lions, and do everything they could, but the animals were never deterred for very long. So they finally approached a group of traders and asked us if we could come up with a behavioral plan. And we did. We came up with a behavioral plan in which we lured the sea lions to a different river where there was better fish, more available, more easily available to them. And we managed, over a period of several years, to relocate 30 or 40 sea lions every single year. We thought, we're being successful. But what happened was, after we relocated those 30 or 40 sea lions, 30 or 40 new sea lions took their place. And so while we were successful at relocating the animals, every time we did it, a whole different group of animals learned about the area and came to it. And so ultimately, the training that we did was successful, but the conservation project was a failure because we were still having sea lions there eating the endangered species of salmon. And so you can see where there are those unexpected things that come up that don't necessarily always solve the problem.
Absolutely. And you mentioned remote training when we talked about it a little. Can we use it? Do you think there is a place for remote training in pet animals training?
Absolutely. The thing about remote training is it really is just finding a way to set up the environment and to set up reinforcers so that you can shape behavior you want without the animal knowing that you're doing that. And I believe that with some of the common pet problems that we see, such as separation anxiety, for example, where animals become terrified or frustrated when their owners are not at home and they tear up the house or they do other things, I believe that remote training is a way where you can set up a remote feeding device, for example, that you trigger and you set up your camera so that you watch, just like you and I are talking to each other and we are seeing each other, but we're on different sides of the world. Well, that same technology that allows us to communicate via the internet can be used to watch our pets and watch our animals, and you can be sitting in your office at work while your camera is watching your pet at home, and when he offers you the correct behavior, you push a button on your computer that spits out a reinforcer of your from your pet tutor or your remote feeding device. And there's a lot of those different kinds of remote feeding devices that are being made today that can allow you to set the environment up that might help your animal to succeed. And when they do the things that you want them to do, you produce a reinforcer and you begin to shape and change their behavior while you're not at home. The animal doesn't even know that you're involved in the process, but you are actively specifically reinforcing particular behaviors. And so I think it does have applications for the pet training world. Once you kind of learn how to use the technology, it's really only limited by our imagination and the way we can creatively think about how we might be able to accomplish this task.
Absolutely, because actually the remote training, as you describe it, is very rarely used in pet animals training. We use remote feeders, remote treat deliveries, but we often use it when we are present in the
environment. Right. A lot of people use these remote feeders and they become a way of teaching an animal to go away from you, to go get something on the other side of the room or across the field, but you're still involved in the process. The nice thing about that technology is if you say, well, if I can teach an animal to go do something away from me, can I get them to do something when they don't see me at all? And the answer is yes, you can. You just have to be creative in how you set that up.
Wow, that could be very helpful in training. And do you always use remote training when you work with wild animals? Or there are some specific cases in conservation projects where you are allowed or you're forced to have a contact with an animal?
Sometimes, yes. It's rare, though. Most of the time, you're not wanting to. Or what you really want to do is you have to have contact with the animals. But interestingly enough, you want to make the contact that you have with the animals aversive. Yeah. You don't want the animals, in other words, for their protection, you want them to be afraid of people. So it might be, for example, that you are doing a project in which you are, one of the first examples that I can give you was the California condor. Back in the 1970s, the California condor is a beautiful bird that was declining in numbers until by 1977, there were only 18 birds left in the world. In the wild, in zoos, 18. And so the Los Angeles Zoo and the San Diego Zoo put together a breeding program for the birds and then began releasing these birds. But of course, at the beginning, they were being raised by people and the birds were so imprinted on people that the birds wanted to hang around people all the time. And that wasn't a good way for wild birds to behave. So a bunch of trainers got together and developed puppets, and they put together these puppets in which the puppet looked like a bird and the puppet raised the little chick, and the birds never saw people except when it was time for a medical exam. So whenever they needed to do a medical exam, then people, undisguised people, would come out and restrain the bird, do the medical exam, and then let them go. So the bird learned people are bad. Yeah. Which is what we wanted them to learn, so that when they were eventually released in the wild, they didn't look for people. They stayed away from people. And so sometimes you need to have in contact with these animals, but you try to make the contact that you have unpleasant so that the animals don't end up becoming so used to people that they seek people out. You want them to actually be afraid of people.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting, but kind of, it's a little bit sad that we need to teach animals to avoid us, because it leads them to dangerous situations. And often we have examples where I think conservation work is needed because of human work, unfortunately, and because of what humans do and how they use animals and how they put them in danger.
Well, exactly. And so it's because of that that we sadly have to teach animals to be afraid of people, because otherwise we put them at greater risk. One of the reasons so many wild animals are at danger is if they get used to being around people, and then people don't know how to behave. You know, the majority of our planet are not animal people. They may like animals, but they're not knowledgeable about animals. And so even people who would never want to purposely hurt an animal often put them at danger. They try to feed them because they think they're cute, or they do things that ultimately change their behavior. But instead, it changes their behavior in the wrong direction. It teaches them to come into villages. It teaches them to go to people's cars. It teaches them to trust humans. And then that's how they end up getting hurt. Or they then put people at risk, because we have some of our national parks here in the United States, for example, where people want to feed the bears. And the bears will come over and take cookies and treats and stuff that's not good for them. But then if at one moment a kid gets out of their car to feed the bear gets scared, it ends up injuring the kid. Well, all of a sudden then to the parents and to the community, the bear is a dangerous animal, and now they want to go kill it because it hurt somebody. And it only got put in that position because of the fact that it was trusting of people. And it's better off that if we want our animals to stay wild, we either need them to not trust people, or we somehow need to educate the public about the right way to work and be around animals. And we've been trying to do that for centuries, and it doesn't seem to work, because the majority of the general public are just not animal people. And I don't mean that in a bad way. They just don't understand. And so consequently, yes, it's a sad thing that in working conservation work, one of the things we have to teach animals is be afraid of people. People are not good. Stay away from them, because it'll help them survive better in the wild.
Yes, it was one of the projects you talked about. I remember about polar bears, right? That you were speaking. It was an issue that they were coming to the villages, wasn't it?
Yes. It was a major project in which polar bears, due to climate change and a variety of other reasons, were coming further and further south into Alaska every year, and they were beginning to cause problems in some of the northern towns and villages. They were attacking dogs and hurting people, and so we had to put a three-part plan in place to help change the behavior of the bears. Now, polar bears are an endangered species, so we don't want to hurt them, we don't want to kill them, we just need to teach them not to come into the towns. The first step, of course, was to teach the townspeople how to manage their garbage, their food that would be thrown away, because often it was the smell of food in a garbage can, or in northern Alaskan villages, they might have meat that they hunted and then have it hanging somewhere to dry, and that will cause the bears to be attracted into the town. So the first thing was a pretty simple educational effort to say, here's the things that you can do to secure your garbage and not put odors into the air that will attract the bears to the village. The second plan was a use of aversive tools. And as someone who is a positive reinforcement trainer, my focus is always on using positive reinforcement. But here was an example where I realized the town already had sentinels or guards that would be watching the town from these high towers. And if they saw the polar bears approaching the town, they would take these shotguns and make these, they're called firecracker shells. They're not meant to kill the bears. They're meant to shoot near the bear to make a loud sound and scare the bears away. So the towns all had these sentinels that were watching for bears and scaring them away from the village. And the noisemakers worked in that they would scare the bear away, but the bear would go around a corner and come back a different direction. And so I realized that they didn't understand behavior. They were scaring the bears, but they weren't making the scary sound contingent on any specific thing. And so my recommendation was what they needed to do was wait and only make the loud, scary sound every time a bear's nose or paw touched something human made. So if it touched a tire, it smelled of a garbage can, it smelled of a fence around a home, at the moment, the very moment that their nose touches the fence, touches the garbage can, smells the tire, that's when you make the loud sound. And very quickly, the bears learn, oh, I'm going to stay away from human-smelling things because they always produce a loud, scary sound. And that was more effective in teaching the bears to stay away from the village than just the random scary things that they would do. And then the third part of the project was to use positive reinforcement to guide the bears toward a location where there was natural food available. So it was that three-pronged approach, and one of them was teaching them to be afraid of human scent, human smells, and man-made things.
Yes, and it's working on behavior. Absolutely. So it's working on the principles of behavior from the antecedent, starting with antecedents and using consequences, because we are working with behavior, even with wild animals, it doesn't change. It applies to every species.
Exactly. It is an amazing thing, but if you study behavior, you understand antecedent behavior consequences. That's what we do to affect the behavior of our dogs. It's how we, if we're wise, we teach our children. And there's no reason it doesn't work with animals in the wild. You just have to figure out, okay, how do I control that environment? How do I set the antecedent arrangements up to be successful? And then when I get the behavior I want, how do I reinforce that behavior? How do I set the consequences up to help affect the behavior the way I need it to be affected?
Yes. And was there any example that of a project that you were involved that you felt that was really challenging and that it was harder than you thought at the beginning?
All of them are all of them were challenging. I mean, they're challenging because, you know, you're talking about looking at an environment and trying to figure out, okay, how do we begin this project? And they're all challenging because of the people involved. They're challenging because of the species. They're challenging because there isn't always a ready-made solution. Certainly one of the projects that I'm involved in right now is an elephant migration project that has been one of the most difficult that I've been involved with, not from a training perspective though. The challenge for us in this particular case, I mean, the training project was difficult and it required figuring out a lot of things because our goal is to change a centuries-old migration route that elephants have used for centuries. Wow. But what's happening is this particular migration route takes them into a dangerous part of Africa where there are no poacher protections. And so the animals, 30 or 40 elephants are being slaughtered every single year when they migrate through this one area because it's in a country that doesn't have, they're leaving one country that has good laws to protect against poachers and passing into a country where they don't have good laws to protect against poachers. And so after 20 some years of political trials to try to find a political solution, tries to put fencing up, tries to do lots of different things, none of those have worked. And so the decision was made, well, let's try a behavioral option. Oftentimes the behavioral option is the last resort. People don't think of using training to solve these kinds of problems first. They try lots of other efforts. But so we are working on a plan to use these behavioral techniques to teach the elephants to go a different route that will actually take them to the same ultimate destination. Elephants migrate for the purposes of finding water, finding resources they need to survive. And so we are utilizing those resources as reinforcers to move them down a new route. But as soon as we started the project, you have to understand that poaching of elephants is a very lucrative profession for poachers. They make their livelihood that way. And as soon as we began that project, as we were setting the project up in beginning, poachers found our location and shot at us. We were shot at by machine guns and by missile launchers. And five of our team were hospitalized, including myself. They tried to kill us. And suddenly realizing, well, this is not just a wonderful effort to try to help elephants. There are dangerous people involved who don't want to see the effort succeed, and they will go to any lengths to stop it from happening. And so suddenly you're already dealing with a very difficult behavioral problem. And now you're adding to that, that you're potentially going into what amounts to a war zone where you could get killed and people are shooting at you and they want you to die and they don't want you to succeed. That adds a whole new wrinkle to the challenges of the behavioral problem, because it's not just the behavioral problem. It's a life or death matter, not just for the elephants, but for those of us who are trying to help the elephants as well. And so conservation projects are never easy, and they're fraught with danger and risks. You're working in less than ideal circumstances in all of these cases, and you always run into to unexpected challenges. So, but it's the thing that makes them interesting as well. There's no two cases that are ever the same. But that's probably true of most behavioral problems. As someone who's worked in the dog training world, for example, I have probably dealt with dozens and dozens of aggressive dogs. Mm-hmm. And the approach that I might take to work with those aggressive dogs is similar, but it's always adapted to the unique environment, to the unique situation, to the circumstances that are around that particular case. It's the same thing with working in the wild. It's just that the variables are far greater and the challenges are far bigger. And so it's they're all challenging, though. But certainly this one I'm involved with now I think every single one that I've ever been involved with at the time, I felt it was the most challenging ever. But it's just that you just realize that you're dealing with unexpected variables, and you have to be able to be flexible. Might put together the best training plan on paper that you've ever come up with, but it doesn't always work. Animals don't behave the way you might have expected them mm-hmm. to. There are other variables that get in the way. And so you end up adjusting and changing the plan many, many, many times.
Yes, and what you mentioned about this terrible story about the poachers, it also shows how important those projects are, and yes. that this is really crucial, because otherwise no one would really help those animals.
Exactly, and part of the challenge here is that often one of the things that is necessary to make a conservation training project successful is you have to work with the local people who live among the animals, because if they don't agree with what you're doing, you're not going to be successful. The challenge with this particular project with the elephants is that the local people who live in the country where the elephants start their migration agree with the project and are very supportive, but not the country that they're going through. And so by not getting those people's buy-in, their agreement to participate, mm-hmm. you run into a problem. And that happens with a lot of conservation projects. Years ago, there was a conservation project in the United States to help protect the Mexican gray wolf. Mm-hmm. And the Mexican gray wolf was disappearing from our forests in northern parts of the United States. So zoos successfully reproduced the Mexican gray wolf. But when it came time to introduce them into the northern parts of our country, ranchers and farmers in those areas didn't want the wolves released there, because they felt that the wolves were going to threaten their cows and their horses and their mm-hmm. livestock. And so if you don't get the ranchers and farmers who live among the wolves to agree to let you release them there, then they're going to be out trying to kill them. They're not going to support the project. And so you always have to have people on the ground working to deal with those kinds of local issues, because you need the people who live among those animals to agree with the project. That was what made the polar bear project so successful, is we would have town meetings with all of the people who lived in that town and say, here's the plan. If you don't agree to follow the plan, it's going to work. It's not going to work. And of course, nobody wants their children threatened by polar bears every evening. Nobody wants polar bears. And so it was easier to get the entire town to agree, because this plan was designed to help keep the polar bears from coming to their town. And so it was easier to get everyone to agree to that project, because that was the whole point of the project, was to help. How do we protect the polar bears but not have them come in conflict with human villages? And so by getting the buy-in of the locals, the project was very successful. We were able to spread this project over 45 different towns and villages over a 5-year period. And it worked in every single town almost perfectly. Why? because everybody agreed to participate. Everybody was motivated to make it work because nobody wants to be killed or hurt by a polar bear, or their see their dogs killed or hurt by a polar bear, or their children killed or hurt by a polar bear. So it was easy to get buy-in. But with the Elephant Project, these elephants are part of the way that poachers make their living. It's a very lucrative thing to kill elephants and use their ivory and use their hides. And so the best way to work on that project would probably be to get people to work with poachers to find them an alternative form of income that would be just as lucrative but doesn't hurt animals. And certainly there are people working on that part of the equation without much success. So meanwhile, the elephant population is declining, but we have not gotten buy-in. And so the project becomes more difficult because of that human issue.
Human issue. So you have to look from so many perspectives when you are preparing a project. It's like the full convergence of every aspect, human, animal, environmental, every single thing has to be taken into consideration.
Yes. And oftentimes you can feel like you're doing this wonderful project only later to realize that there are people who don't think it's such a wonderful idea. I remember back in 1989, I was asked to go up to Alaska to help with an oil spill cleanup. The Exxon Valdez had spilled oil into Alaska, and it was obliterating so much wildlife. And so a lot of people went up to Alaska to help clean up the beaches and clean up the oil and rescue wildlife. And because of my experience with marine life, I was asked to go up and help with a sea otter rehabilitation project. I was working at the Sea Otter Center, where we would get oiled otters and clean them up, nurse them back to health, then release them again. And I was very proud of this project. I was part of this very, very helpful project to help sea otters. So I remember I'd been at the Sea Otter Center for about a week, and I hadn't really gotten to meet anybody in the town. And there was a regular town hall meeting in which all of the officials would let everybody know how much oil had spilled that week, how many beaches had been cleaned up, how many eagles had been rescued, how many otters had been rescued and killed. And as I was at this town meeting, very proud of the fact that I'm working at the Sea Otter Rescue Center, they get to the part where they talk about the sea otters. And when they announced the fact that that particular day, 72 sea otters had been found dead, the entire hall erupted in cheers, applauding and cheering. And I was puzzled. I was like, oh my God, these people want the otters killed. Well, it turns out the majority of people in that town are fishermen. And the sea otters are one of their biggest competition. The sea otters tear open their nets and eat their fish. And so they consider sea otters a pest. In their mind, the death of sea otters was the one good thing that was coming out of this oil spill. And I realized how many different perspectives people look at an issue. I am working day and night, 14 hours every day, cleaning and rescuing otters to release them in the wild. And the majority of townspeople don't like what I'm doing. They don't think I should be rescuing sea otters. Rescue the bald eagle, rescue the fish, rescue these other animals, but they have a very narrow view. They don't think about it from an ecosystem perspective or an ecological perspective. They just know that sea otters harm their profession because the sea otters eat their fish and tear open their nets. They are a pest, and let's get rid of them. And it was one of the first times, and since then I see it all the time, mm-hmm. that you can feel like you're doing a good thing, something that you feel is the right thing for the environment, the right thing for a species, and you realize that not everybody sees it the same way you do. And that is the very eye-opening thing, but it makes it challenging for us to accomplish some of these projects, because I think these conservation projects are a good thing for our planet, but that's my opinion. It's my perspective. And certainly the people that are helping me with those projects agree with me. Mm-hmm. But the fact that I was almost killed last year and that I was in a hospital in a coma because people tried to kill me for helping elephants, it's very sobering. It's very, you realize that not everybody sees the planet the same way, and not everybody sees an issue the same way. And that shouldn't be a surprise to us. We see challenges in the political world all the time. We see differences of opinion on all sorts of things. It's no different in how we take care of animals. And so it just adds an extra challenge to this work that I think is so important.
Yes, and I think it also allows you to prepare maybe better next time if you realize that people have different approach to what you do. When you mentioned about sea otters, we had the same situation in Poland and Baltic Sea this summer. We found so many dead sea otters on the beach because fishermen started to kill them because they steal fish from the nests. And it became a problem because we have environmental companies that try to protect them. And this is the same situation as you've been describing. There are people Absolutely. Working to save those animals, and because they are endangered in Poland. And right. here we have people who want them dead because right. they are a pest, as you said, for them.
Right.
This is, yeah, this is very, very sobering. I agree, absolutely. And also, just to sum up our conversation, I have a quote from you, from one of your lectures, and I think this would be a great to tell, because people, if they want to start working with another species, they sometimes feel puzzled, and if it is it may be too challenging. And if I may read the quote, it's in any endeavor we choose to embark on, our success is limited by our knowledge, our willingness to put forth the effort, and our imagination. Each of those are only self-imposed limitations.
Yes, that's I very much believe that. I always say that when I talk about conservation training. I appreciate you reading that quote. I use that quote often when people are facing projects that they feel are insurmountable, and oftentimes it just requires a little ingenuity, a little imagination, a little bit of thinking outside the box. No matter what project we want to accomplish and whatever thing we want, endeavor that we embark upon, the reality is, with a little ingenuity, a little creative thought, there isn't any reason we can't accomplish it. So often we are our own worst enemies because we say, oh, that's too hard, that's too difficult, that's not possible. As soon as you say that something's not possible, you might as well quit trying. The reality is, it may be difficult, but it's rarely impossible. You have to just really find a different way to approach the problem. And if you keep thinking about it, get team members and colleagues to help you, you can overcome whatever the challenge is, and you can find a solution. It just requires a little bit of tenacity and a little bit of a positive attitude to say, we're gonna solve this. We just have to find the right way to do it.
Okay, thank you so much. I think this is just a brilliant summary of what we've been talking about. So well, thank you for joining me today.
I'm really glad I could. I hope it opens some people's eyes to some possibilities of things that they might be able to do.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next episode, we'll talk about horses, and Alexandra Kurland is the next guest. Hit the subscribe button to be informed, and don't miss the next episode.